Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Albert Morales, and today's conversation is with Dr. Carolyn Clancy, Director of the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality within HHS. Also joining us today from IBM is Janet Marchibroda. Dr. Clancy, as a country, the U.S. spends far more on healthcare than any other nation. Yet numerous studies have found that there is really no relationship between spending and the quality of care. First, what is quality in healthcare? And to that end, could you elaborate on the three basic dimensions for getting the right care to the right patient at the right time, every time?
Yes, I'd be delighted. So I think you just gave what I think of as the best definition of healthcare quality: the right care for the right patient at the right time, every time. And the every time really refers to your confidence in knowing that if you went to practice A as opposed to practice B, or if you live in one state or region versus another, that you'd be getting the same care that's consistent with the best that we know in science as it applies to you as a unique individual. In general, we think about healthcare quality as having three components. Structure are literally the structures, the hospitals, the professionals who provide care, and so forth. And historically, we have put a great deal of emphasis on that. We want to know that hospitals have all the right facilities and equipment, that they can sterilize things and so forth, that the professionals who are on staff have had good training and can do a good job and have the kind of training that we would expect in this country. Unfortunately, what we've learned over the past 20 years is that structure doesn't always predict accurately what happens to people, that is to say, the process, what kind of care they get, or the outcomes or end results. So process of care is literally what kinds of treatments you're given, what kinds of tests are ordered to make a diagnosis, and so forth. Do you get a mammogram, for example, if you're a woman in the right age range, looking for a way to detect possible breast cancer early? If you are unfortunate enough to have a heart attack, do you get timely treatment and so forth? That's all about the process, what's going on. And what all of us care about is the end result. Am I better off as a result of all this health care? That can get a little bit tricky to measure because there's many things that affect end results. For example, people who are wealthier tend to do better than poor people. We know that people who are well-educated tend to do better than people who are not so well-educated. But overall, what we want to make sure is that what we do for patients matches their needs and preferences and actually helps them to get on with their lives and not worry so much about what's going on in healthcare.
Now, according to your statistics from the National Healthcare Quality Report, healthcare quality improved by about 3.1% in 2006. However, in the last couple of years, the rate of improvement in healthcare quality has actually gone down. Could you tell us more about the causes behind either the slow progress or decline in improvement? But more importantly, what are some of the key actions for accelerating improvement altogether?
Well, I'm so glad that you mentioned the National Healthcare Quality Report. We are required by the U.S. Congress to report every year on the state of healthcare quality in America and also on disparities in care associated with patients' individual characteristics, including race, ethnicity, their income, education, where they live, and so forth. And on one level, we have seen since we started in 2003 steady improvements every year. So I will celebrate that movement in the right direction. At the same time, that movement is pretty modest. I don't want to say glacial, but it would be close. We're not moving as rapidly as we can and really must do to meet the needs of the people that we're serving. Just by way of example, only one half of obese adults and children report that they've actually had the issue discussed by a clinician with them. One in seven hospitalized Medicare beneficiaries has actually experienced a serious adverse event in the past year. And when we look at specific aspects of safe care, we see that that's actually declined about 1% a year over the past 6 years. So at the end of the day, we haven't really made a lot of progress on the overarching finding in all quality studies, which is that there's a substantial gap between best possible care and that which is routinely delivered to all of us, and that that gap is larger still for people who are members of racial or ethnic minority groups, people who are poor, not well educated, and so forth. There's absolutely no reason we can't move faster on this, and I think that's going to be a critical part of health reform.
On a somewhat related note, according to the CDC, nearly 2 million patients suffer from a healthcare-associated infection in U.S. hospitals each year, resulting in 99,000 deaths and incurring an estimated $28 to $33 billion in excess healthcare costs annually. Could you tell us about ARC's efforts to improve and expand healthcare-associated infection prevention efforts? Specifically, Dr. Clancy, what are some of the ways to reduce or eliminate such infections?
So this is a growing problem, and it's one that people understand very, very easily. You know, what's wrong with this picture? My family member went into the hospital with one problem, and they came out with a second problem, a very serious infection. We've seen famous people and not so famous people at all suffering serious consequences because of these infections, which are largely avoidable. There are many causes of the infections, but one of the areas that I'm very proud of has to do with some work we supported a few years ago in the state of Michigan. So we supported a team from Hopkins to do something that was ultimately called the Keystone Project. What they were focusing on was reducing serious bloodstream infections. Now, these can be deadly, make no mistake about it. And these infections can be caused by IV lines that are put in centrally. Some relatively straightforward steps can actually reduce the infection rate dramatically. What they did was to test their strategy at Hopkins. They came to ARC for a grant, although most of the project was funded by Blue Cross and Blue Shield in Michigan. We were supporting the specific evaluation and so forth. And what they did was to come up with a fairly simple strategy. It sounds simple, but it's deceptively simple, a checklist for what all members of the healthcare team needed to do. They had leadership at every hospital in Michigan. Now, we're talking from the major academic medical centers right down to very tiny hospitals, but they had them engaged at all of these hospitals, and they made data collection very easy. That was done through the Michigan Hospital Association, and the teams got quarterly feedback. So shared commitment, engagement of leadership, relatively straightforward data collection, and quarterly feedback so that people could see the connection between their daily work and what was happening with the infection rates. And the results were profound and dramatic. In some cases, many of these hospitals have not had one of these infections for many months. So right now, starting about 6 months ago, we are working with the American Hospital Association's Health Research Education Trust, their research arm, to partner with 10 states to do what happened in Michigan all over again. And we got additional funding in this year's budget to expand to an additional 20 states. We think that we can make a big dent in this problem, if not wipe it out entirely over the next couple of years. It is probably the single largest example of success at improving quality and safety, and one that's been done to scale. So I think there's a lot of very important lessons to be learned from that.
That's very exciting. What would you say are some of the barriers or challenges to fostering a culture of infection safety?
I think one of the challenges in terms of establishing a culture is that all of the nation's hospitals and other facilities have incredibly well-trained professionals working there, but they're not always working on exactly to the same music, if you will. Nursing is doing what they know well, doctors are doing what they know, and at the end of the day, what we know is that high-quality, safe care is a team sport. That's much easier to say than to make it happen, but creating the spirit of a team so that we're all on the same page or checklist, in the case of the Keystone Project, is incredibly important. I think it's also very important that ultimately we figure out in a scalable way how to make data collection to let us know how we're doing really easy with pretty timely feedback. I think this quarterly feedback that the Keystone Project had is going to be very, very important. So as we anticipate reforming the healthcare system, a lot of emphasis on improving healthcare delivery, I think this same issue of making data collection as easy as possible, and health IT should be helping with that, and feeding the information back so that everyone, from the person who transports patients up to the highest trained physician to the CEO, understands how all these dots connect.
I understand that the purpose of ARC's prevention care management portfolio is to increase the adoption and delivery of evidence-based clinical services, both preventive and chronic disease-related, to improve the health of all Americans. Could you elaborate on how your agency makes this happen? And also, what role does the United States Preventive Services Task Force play in your efforts?
I would say almost 30 years ago, something fairly dramatic happened in the practice of clinical medicine. Up until that point, when patients came in to see a doctor, the very common question that both patients and doctors had, although they didn't always speak to each other about it directly, was what tests should I have or what tests should I order? What happened starting in the late 70s up in Canada and then ultimately here was to shift the focus from what tests should I order to what diseases or conditions can we detect early, where we know there's an effective treatment, and that we know where that early detection will make a difference. And the Preventive Services Task Force was born. It was actually initially sponsored by the department, the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Health. It moved to ARC about 15 years ago. So this is an independent group of nationally renowned researchers and scientists, and their focus is on making evidence-based recommendations about preventive care. Now, they take their job incredibly seriously. We support their work, but we don't have to agree with them. They are an independent team. That task force relies on the support that ARC provides to give them the best science. We support this through systematic reviews of the literature and so forth. And they go through a very deliberative process to make recommendations that are graded on the strength of the evidence. So A is the gold star rating. The evidence is outstanding. Absolutely, this should be done. B is the evidence isn't quite as good as A, but it's still impressive. C is sort of neutral. D means the service may actually cause harm. And the I rating means there's insufficient evidence to say for or against doing this. All of these recommendations are framed in the context of good clinical judgment because there's no substitute for that. We do sometimes have challenges explaining the I rating. Insufficient evidence that something is effective is not the same thing as saying that it's ineffective. And, you know, people are extremely excited about prevention. So sometimes when a service that they think just has to be important and good to do, it gets an I rating from the task force, they're a little bit disappointed. But we think, and the task force thinks, it's incredibly important to stick to the science and not to go beyond the science. So if the science stops, they will say we don't have enough evidence. Sometimes that actually prompts our colleagues at NIH to support research that will help us develop better evidence. That's happening right now, for example, at the National Institute on Drug Abuse, because the task force gave an I rating to screening people for evidence of substance abuse. So that's very exciting when it happens. We also make the findings available to clinicians. There's a terrific application that you can download from our website or just use it online, the Electronic Prevention Service Selector. The reason for this is the prevention recommendations tend to be framed in terms of age, gender, some family history characteristics, and so forth. So it's a little bit hard to do in two dimensions. But this immediately gives you the recommendation. And it's framed the way doctors want the information. We talk to lots and lots of physicians. They want the bottom line first, but they also want to know that they can get to the underlying evidence. So that's exactly how this application works.
Now, Dr. Clancy, I'm increasingly hearing the term patient-centered medical home. Can you tell me what this is and how does this patient model represent a fundamental shift in the relationship between a patient and their primary care physician?
Yes, this is a development that we're very, very excited about. And in the interest of full disclosure, I'll tell you that I am a primary care internist, so I care a lot about primary care. Healthcare these days is incredibly fragmented. And if I ever forget, I talked to my father, who's 80 and sees multiple physicians in the context of a large organization where there is more information sharing than necessarily occurs routinely between individual practices that don't share a common infrastructure. But it gets very, very confusing to navigate. So one of the key tenets of a medical home is that many, many people would do much better if they were working with a clinician whose job it was to be the medical quarterback, if you will, to help them coordinate care and not necessarily provide all of it, but actually to know which specialist to refer to track what happened to them and so forth. So this is an idea. The term originally comes out of pediatrics, but it's been one that's been embraced faced by internists, by family physicians, nurse practitioners, and many others. This year, the federal government for Medicare is actually going to sponsor a demonstration to see how well this works for Medicare beneficiaries. Now, if you think about it, to take the responsibility for being a medical home, practices actually have to be able to track patients' test results, what happens when they're referred to specialists, you know, review their medicines with them, and electronic health records can be a big help here. We'll see how well this works. Clearly, people who are relatively healthy may not have such a high need for this kind of approach, whereas people like my father or other people with multiple chronic illnesses would do incredibly well.
So the ultimate goal of your mission is to disseminate ARC's research findings, which hopefully result in healthier, more productive individuals and an enhanced return on our nation's substantial investment in healthcare. Could you elaborate on ARC's efforts to translate these research findings into clinical practice and to disseminate them to the key stakeholders? And are you using some of the Web 2.0 and social networking technologies in facilitating this process?
So, you know, we work extensively to communicate what we're doing and to disseminate that in a way that's practical. And that ranges from everything from like the prevention test selector tool to actually providing technical assistance on occasion to writers for TV shows who want to know about a medication error, what does that look like, and so forth. We do a lot of work in terms of direct outreach to the media, in terms of publishing in many specific journals, which may be both scientific peer-reviewed journals as well as sort of professionally organization-based. We do a lot of speaking at meetings. But we also work with the Ad Council to try to make it seem fun for patients to ask questions, because we know that patients who are active in managing their own health and healthcare tend to have better outcomes than those who are more passive. And we do podcasts, and I think we're tweeting now, and there's no media that we won't take advantage of.
So you're out there then. Yeah. What is comparative effectiveness research? We will ask Dr. Carolyn Clancy, Director of the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, to share with us when our conversation about healthcare continues on the Business of Government Hour.